Okay, Shavua Tov, everybody, on the, I guess, officially last of the long Saturday nights. Yes? Okay, at least until 2 a.m. I hope everybody's well. Okay, it's a pleasure to welcome you all to our, what should be a fascinating panel on Who Decides Who Decides, Halakha Authority and the Shaping of Community Norms. And really, I want to thank, the way the program came together is, Professor Saman, we organized the program a while ago, and then he asked me if I know Elie Fischer. So we had met by email, but that's the way you meet today. And he said he's going to be in town too. I said, great, we'll do a program, you know, together. And they came up with the idea, you know, Who Decides Who Decides. I think it's a beautiful title. They said, let's add, of course, we're in Ontario. Let's try to get somebody who decides from an Ontario point of view. So that's, we invited Sharon, and really is, want to thank you all for coming and being on the panel. Just a very quick introduction. What we're going to do is each of the three speakers is going to give a 5 to 7 minute introduction. And then they'll basically have a discussion among themselves with you. We'll open up the floor to questions, so everything, and we'll see how it goes. Okay. We'll start, I guess, by the order of who's going to speak first, which is Rabbi Elie Fischer, who lives in Modi'in, and who is worked many years ago as the JLRC director at the University of Maryland. He's a translator. He's working on a PhD on Rav Asher Weiss in Jewish history, and he does the translations for the Pnine Halakha series of Rav Elazar Malama. Afterwards, Chaim Saman, who is a professor of law at Villanova University, will be speaking. He's been here for the last couple of weeks teaching at the University of Toronto Law School, just published this excellent book, Halakha, Princeton University Press, and it's a pleasure to have you and to welcome you, and then get home with your family after 2 weeks. And Sharon Shore, of course, a native of Toronto, was recently appointed to the Justice of the Ontario Superior Court of Justice here in Toronto, a former partner at Epstein Coel. So without further ado, we'll call on Rabbi Fischer to get our proceedings started.
Thank you.
And if you can turn off the ringer on your cell phone, that would be greatly appreciated.
Okay, fine. When we talk about book history, there really are two histories. One begins when the other one ends. That's the history of composition and the history of reception. When it comes to halakha, when it comes to halakhic texts, reception isn't really something that we're trained to think about. We hear Rav Moshe Feinstein says this, the Shulchan Aruch Paskins this, but we don't think much about the process by which a statement like Rav Moshe Feinstein says this is okay carries authoritative meaning. Just the other day, I was reading an article by a law professor from Tel Aviv University named Asaf Luchovsky, and he points out 8 trends in intellectual history of Jewish law and law in general, and Jewish law scholarship. And this was published in 2017, and he doesn't mention reception, the study of reception, as one of the trends. Which means that this is really new. This is really something that we're not used to studying it, not from a scholarly perspective, and certainly not in the world of the yeshivas. There are certainly studies that compare canonic works with minor works. Like, for example, if you want to study the history of the Shulchan Aruch, see what else was published around the time of the Shulchan Aruch, what else was published around the time of the responsa of the Noda Yehuda, whatever it is, so that you can get a broader picture of the world within which they were writing, within which they were composing. But that doesn't really get into the question of, well, as important as that question is, it doesn't get into the question of how this work became canonic, how it became authoritative, how it became that a statement like this responsum of the Noda B'Yehuda, of Yecheskel Landau, becomes a normative statement. Something that one person wrote becomes something that carries normative weight. How does that happen? Why is it that this work became authoritative while another contemporary work was relegated to the dustbin? The answers to these questions are not, I believe, they're not doctrinal. They're not theories of rabbinic authority like the one written by my teacher, Michael Rosenzweig. I think they're important works, but they're looking at it from the top-down perspective. They're looking at it from the perspective of the creation of halachic texts, not from the perspective of the receivers, of those who have to accept it. And this is true today as much as it was before. Nobody ever sent out an APB saying, oh, by the way, right now, Rav Asher Weiss, or Rav Eliezer Melamed, or Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, they're the posek hador now. There was never any formal decision. These are emergent realities. He was here in Toronto a few weeks ago, if you heard him, which means that his word carries some weight here, and more local rabbis are asking him questions. I actually, in my trip to America now, I got to see a lot of how various Israeli poskim are being received in real time. And I'm going to have some thoughts. I'll probably put them down on paper. And then in the coming weeks, I see how it's going. I see how people are reading these new halachic texts, like, as Jay mentioned, Rav Melamed's texts and Rav Asher Weiss. And I'm seeing how they're being received in real time, and it's been eye-opening. And these are the sorts of questions that interest me, that tie together a lot of the different things that I'm interested in. And really, when you boil it down, the question, what we want to find is what we call the quantum of authority. It could be a responsum, or it could be just a question that a person asks somebody that they deem to be more expert by phone or in shul on an average weekday. And those questions, one person asks another, it's always anchored in choice. Whenever I pose a question to a posek, I have a choice to make. There's always more than one. Whenever anyone asks a question to a rabbi, there's always a choice. There's always a different rabbi that can be asked. And so the question that we're asking is, if that's the quantum of authority, that question, that choice to ask this person and not that person, if that's the quantum of authority, what goes into that choice? How is that decision made? And what can we learn from the process by which that choice is made? Right, that's fine.
Okay, thank you. So what Ellie didn't say is that Ellie and I have been having some version of this conversation since we met in Karaviyavne in 1993. So it's great fun to be here and to talk to him and to talk to you about this. So I want to sort of follow up, and I totally agree with what Ellie said. And said that, you know, like typically when we think of halacha, we're thinking of like what's in the halacha or in any other statement. But as a lawyer and a legal scholar, one of the things that's interesting about halacha is there's something phenomenal. There's no state, there's no coercive infrastructure, and yet everyone in this room recognizes something we call halachic authority. And from a theoretical and practical perspective, like how? We're so used to thinking of law, and we'll see what the judge says, in a state sense, that well, if you violate it, there's police, there's judge, there's orders, there's taxing, right? And yet, there's something I think amazing. Now, following what Ellie said, I would say 30 years ago, when secular non-Jewish law scholars were interested in Jewish law, they were largely like asking questions, well, what is the Jewish law of contract? What's the Jewish law of tort? And what's changed very much in line with this is that the reason Jewish law is now of interest has very little to do with any substantive rules, and much more, how does a community create its own legal order without any of the institutions of state? And I think that that the phenomenon of authority is quite amazing. Because though we have our disagreements, of course, we choose. But think of how much agreement there is. And the question is, what holds us up? What holds us together? And rabbinic authority is actually, to me, one of the most impressive forms of authority that we have in the modern context, precisely because no one is making you do it. You can just say, I don't care. And you suffer no civil penalty, no one throws you in jail. What you do suffer, and what does hold it together, is a social bond that we have. And I want to think a little bit as we go on tonight about how that works. And here's the basic model. The way I think of it is that I think in terms of concentric circles of signaling. So you can imagine a posek, someone we recognize as a posek in the middle. In the first tier are people who often, or almost always, comply. In the second tier are people who do so less. In the third tier, less. Now when someone in the third tier doesn't comply, we don't take that as a very important signal because they're third tier. But as you move closer and closer to people who are typically complying, and all of a sudden they're sending signals that they're not complying or that they're willing to, so all of a sudden that norm becomes looser. And what you really have is everyone is kind of looking around predicting how other people are going to react. And when everyone predicts that we're going to enforce this norm, all of a sudden, that becomes the halacha in the community. And when there's more debate and dissension about it, and people are predicting, well, maybe yes, maybe no, then that changes. So let me give some examples. You will notice every now and again that some Hasidic Rebbe will say that no weddings in my community over $50,000. You will also notice that everybody knows that doesn't actually mean that. So how? Right? The story from the outside, Chassidus Rebbe, Das Torah, what they say always goes. And what we see is, yeah, that often is true. But it's interesting to look at when that's not true. So somewhere in that community, there's like a Torah Shabbal Peh that says that when the Rebbe says, no weddings over 50,000, that means maybe take it down a notch. Now how do we know? Well, in part because people are signaling. They throw fancier weddings and people come. You know who else comes? The Rebbe comes. If the Rebbe didn't come, then there would be a signal that this norm is being enforced in a different way. Let's imagine, let's go more to our world. Modern Orthodox Shul. Rabbi gets up and says, you know, guys, movies are awesome. Everybody knows. Yeah, nice, okay, we get it. Rabbi says, on Pesach, you shouldn't eat this hashgach or quinoa. Rabbi says, oh, this baby is yellow. We're not doing the bris today. 100% compliance. In other words, that there is a mechanism that I think is based on a kind of oscillating and bidirectional or multidirectional communal sense that says, when he says no movies, that's like some kind of aspiration. You guys should sort of be a little less secular. When he says this baby's not having a bris, that baby ain't having a bris. Now, the rabbi also knows this, right? And therefore, he will not make too many of those movie pronouncements because he knows no one's going to listen. How do I know? Because I'll sit with them on Shabbos and say, you know, I really wish I could tell these people X, Y, and Z. Right? You've all heard rabbis say some version. What are they saying? What they're saying is, I understand that the signaling device will be that this won't be accepted. Okay, that's our community. Now, I want to tell a story about, so what about in the Haredi community? Das Torah. So we're all so used to this view that whatever the Gedolim say goes. And you know what? Often that's true. But it's interesting actually to look at the times that that's not true. So imagine you have a school with a certain gadol as its head of the halachic committee. So if that rav says that you can't have co-ed classes after third grade, I promise you there will be no classes after third grade. But if that Rob says that he's not so into vaccines and that the school should accept kids even if they're not vaccinated, you know what might happen? The school board might get together and say, listen, we don't do halacha. As a matter of school policy, we're not accepting any children who don't have their vaccination record unless there's a medical exception. But the Gadol said, we all live and we're so conditioned that Das Torah is, the answer is sure. When the signaling devices work, such that everyone's predicting that this decree will be enforced, and everyone is willing to enforce it by signaling themselves and shunning people who don't do it, sure. But if there's a big enough disconnect, then you see that the Gadol says something and the community goes and does the exact opposite. Now, it's probably smart enough not to run headfirst into it and say, as a matter of halacha, we disagree, but it's just gonna find ways to do it. So then we ask, like, what is the halacha? Is halacha the pronouncement? Or is halacha the school policy? Or is it some kind of complicated dance between those? Maybe the last thing that just came up, another example of this, and then I'll pass it off. Another example that came up about 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, it was reported somewhere that Rav Herschel Schechter said that drawing a picture of the sun and the moon is prohibited. Now, he didn't make this up. This is a siman in Shulchan Aruch. Now, everybody knows that every kindergarten and first grade and third grade, right, has the kids do projects with the sun and the moon and the stars in the picture. Now, is it, when I say it's a prediction game, do I mean that the textual, traditionally, the sort of formal halachic sources don't matter? No, I don't mean that at all. They matter because those things themselves shape people's predictions. So, for example, it is true that the Shulchan Aruch says that. But it's also true that the Taz says, that only applies to three-dimensional, not to two-dimensional. It's also true that Rav Moshe says that school children's drawings are so inexact and so not like the sun that no one's worried he's going to worship them. It's also worth knowing that people say, oh, it's for chinuch, it's okay. There's even a chew about, can you draw the thing of Yosef's dream? The sun and the moon and the stars. Now, I would say it's not just that those sources exist that are kind of a certain signaling that the absolute rule of no sun isn't the halacha, but those sources themselves emerge from a reality where people are doing it. And therefore, the way I would like to think of it is that there's this like, constant dialogue between not just between a posek and the people, but all sorts of different types of people who are each either signaling their acceptance, signaling their willingness to shun someone who doesn't, so that if someone drives in a frum shul on Shabbos, we're all going to shun them. Certainly if they're like, you know, if last week they kept Shabbos and all of a sudden they show up, we're not going to bite them our hat, right? There's going to be a huge reaction to it. And that, to me, is how halachic norms become propagated. That it's some dance between the sources, the acceptance, and then it's bi-directional and constantly iterative. So look forward to talking more about that. Thank you.
Okay, picking up from where Chaim left off, from a civil standpoint, from the secular point of view, I think the same is true, that the laws, the secular laws, also adjust to the norms, also adjust to the normal, the standards and the expectation of society. So in state law, specifically in Canada, the laws are made up by either the government or we're a common law society, so it's made up through judgments and judges and how it evolves and what previous people have decided and what the norms of society are. So there are two ways for society then to control or mandate how the laws are made. The first is when government makes law, It's done by our representatives. It's got to pass through Parliament. It's got to pass through the Senate, and then it's made into law. But what happens when society doesn't accept the laws? What happens when we have problems with the laws that are being enacted? Well, we have elections. And if you don't like what your members of Parliament are doing, they won't be reelected in the next, in the upcoming election. So that's one way that we have the ability to shape. But the other way to do it is through common laws, through the ways that judges and decisions are made in a society. So if a common law is a body of law derived from judicial decisions rather than from statutes and constitutions, and they interpret and uphold the laws, and they have the ability to strike down laws that are not constitutional. So the common law has the ability to shape law based on what the norms are. And one example of that in Canada, the most recent example of that, has to do with the right of same-sex couples to marry. That was initially a judicial decision that said that the fact that only separate sexes, opposite sexes, only a man and a wife can be married, is an issue that it's not constitutional because it's a prejudice against the people who are same-sex, and the law was struck down, and then government had to reenact or create a new bill that says that same-sex couples have the right to marry. So that's a very, very recent change in the law that came about through judicial decisions. So social norms, not only in halakha, seem to affect who decides, but also in state law and civil law, who decides are our representatives, who we, in a democratic society, elect or don't re-elect, and through our judiciary system, through challenging the laws, through society challenging the norms and challenging the laws, our laws change as well. So one of the things that I wanted to pick up from Chaim's discussion, though, was also to talk about specifically, well, what happens in Toronto? What happens when, and I think I was asked to speak for two different reasons. One is to talk about state law and how Canadian law comes about and how Canadian law shifts and how the norms in society, just like halakha, will sometimes dictate what those laws are or who has the authority to decide, who gives them, who decides who decides. Well, we in a democratic society decide who decides. But also in Toronto, looking at more of a halakha, looking at it from a Canadian perspective. And the perfect example there is when dealing with the Beit Din and Halakha, what happens when civil law and Halakha don't mesh? And the two most recent examples are, one is in family law, where the Arbitration Act and the Family Law Act here were amended and said that before, the Beit Din here could hear family law matters and it would be binding. If the Beit Din as an arbitration panel made a decision and gave an arbitration award and somebody wasn't listening to that award, they could take it to the state, they can bring it to before a judge, and a judge would enforce it. That was taken away, that authority or the enforcement of those decisions was taken away, partly because of the concern of Sharia law. But what they basically decided in Ontario is that unless you're a deemed family law arbitrator, you can no longer they will no longer enforce family law arbitration. So here you have a Beit Din and you have halakha saying, you know, family law matters have to come before a Beit Din, and they used to be enforced, and now they're no longer enforceable. And what do you do? And it's interesting to see how the Beit Din has been grappling with it. And in some circumstances, you have the Beit Din saying, we're not going to decide because there's no authority, there's no ability for it to be enforced. You also have a Beit Din saying, well, we do have the authority to enforce it within the social norm, so we are still going to hear. But it's a change in a civil matter that has shifted the way our Beit Dins do work not just Ontario, but Beijing and Montreal is also dealing with this, is how they're dealing with changes in the way that they do business because of the changes in the civil law. Another perfect example is the duty to report. There's an absolute obligation in Ontario and in Canada to report child abuse and suspected child abuse or concerns about children. It's an absolute positive obligation on certain professions, such as teachers and doctors, social workers, and many others, lawyers. And the law came into effect that it's an absolute obligation and duty to report. But then you have Aguda who came out and said that you should not be reporting things to secular organizations, that you first must deal with it within the confines of the Jewish community and with your rabbi. So here's another example of the way that halacha and interpretations and authorities the concept of who decides, the community decided that, you know what, there's got to be something different about the way that we do business or the way that we report things. And what happened was you ended up with two things. First of all, Agudat Israel came out and said, actually, let us clarify what we meant. And they clarified it by saying, yes, you absolutely should be reporting in certain circumstances, but they still kept the caveat that you should be deciding with your rabbi and not making your own decision on whether or not it's the appropriate circumstance to report. But then you also came out with a proclamation that over 100 rabbis signed, all Orthodox rabbis, all very prominent rabbis, some of them from our community, some of them from Israel, some of them from the States, who came out and said, no, you absolutely have a positive obligation to report. That you are not limited to just reporting to within our community, but that you absolutely have a positive. So that was a shift, because the community norms wouldn't accept or had difficulty following what Aguda had come out and said. So I think we're going to stop now and have a discussion.
So I'll just throw out the first question then. If in a few minutes, if you have any questions, we'll put the mic in the middle. We'll ask a few questions in a row, and then we'll let the panelists discuss. I just want to, perhaps you can address two issues I was thinking, or related issue. The Maritz Chaitz, 150 years ago, wrote an article about 50 halachot that are ignored in Jewish community. This is what it says in Shulchan Aruch. That's not what people do. That was the end of it. He just ushered them. That's one. How do we sort of deal with that and authority? And secondly, the notion of the Gemara that, you know, you look to the people to see what the halacha. And I want you to put that in the context of sort of what's happened in our society today. Of that Torah for sure in the in the non-Orthodox, in the right, more right-wing world, but even in the modern Orthodox world, you know, you want to Rabbani making, you know, proclamations in our world, and how we balance this. If you want to perhaps address that, then we'll take it from there.
All right. So, with regard to the Maritz Chaitz, Maritz Chaitz is great, and in a lot, Maritz Chaitz was, we'll give a little bit of biographical information. He was mid 19th century. He was the rabbi in Zolkiv in Poland. And he sort of straddled the borderline between traditional Orthodox rabbi and somebody who had maskilic leaning tendencies. He was attracted to the Enlightenment. He also had some other quirks in that he was very, he wanted to ban all, he was Puritan when it came to halacha, almost puritanical, in that he wanted to banish any charismatic element from halacha. And he actually got into a whole polemic with the Chatam Sofer at the end of his life, in the 1830s, and Maritz Chius was a young young rabbi at the time, and they got into it, and the tshuvot that Chatam Sofer wrote to the Maritz Chius, he deletes the name. He doesn't even want to say who he's writing to. And there's words of encouragement like, don't go down this road, you know, come back and, you know, be, you know, toe the party line. There's some interesting dialogue there. And there was a dissertation written on the Maritz Chius, Chayes. The dissertation was written by Bruria Huttner David, the daughter and only child of Rav Yitzchak Huttner, the Rosh Yeshiva of Torah Vadas. So, Chaim Berlin. Sorry. Chaim Berlin. The Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin. So, it's an interesting question. I'll say something. Let's say this, for example. Yes, there are a number of dead letter halachot in Shulchan Aruch. Nobody observes them. Okay? Try printing a version of the Shulchan Aruch missing those halachot. Let me know how that works out for you. Okay? That there's a certain, even halachot that are not observed, there's a perceived importance of leaving them on the books. And that maybe we'll reinterpret them, or we'll find some way to show why they're no longer relevant, why we no longer observe them, why we no longer refrain from drinking water for an hour in some day in Tammuz, right when the tekufas, whatever these halachot are, there's always some explanation why we don't, some justification for it, but never is the justification, well, yeah, obviously if we don't do it, it's not important, so we can just cross it out. In terms of Dat Torah, so Das Torah is a doctrine, but I'm not interested in it so much as a doctrine. I'm interested in it as, let's say, a reality, as a fact. The fact is that if somebody says something and that has cachet and that generates obedience, then we have to look at that as a social phenomenon and as a phenomenon that is an important feature of the history of halakha or the history of Jewish communal norms. As a doctrinal thing, oh, is it based on what the, is that really the correct reading of the Sefer HaChinuch? Is this really what the Rambam thought? That interests me less. So I don't see it as a doctrinal question, really.
So, well, I want to pick up on something that Sharon said that reminded me that using my signaling theory, sometimes our arguments are just about the signals. So because you brought up the same-sex marriage or whatnot, you think within Orthodoxy, there's no disagreement that homosexuality is usur. Our disagreements are about our social signaling of disapproval. Right, it's like interesting to think about that. We're not at the phase at all where we're arguing about the halachic status. Right, the arguments are on the right a sort of very strong negative social signals, and sort of as you move to the center and the left, weaker social signals. So sometimes our debates are just about the signals themselves. As to the Maritz Chius's Shulchan Aruch, so I think that's right, and what you want to. But we all know, right, that there's a bunch of halachot that will that are not going to become dead letter, right? And then your question is, and this is sort of like, what is the process through which that happens? So it tells you that as a text, what Eli said before, when we say the Shulchan Aruch governs, well, kind of, but no, it's the Shulchan Aruch backed by the people in various ways, and people could be, and to me, people is not simply amcha, it's this kind of complex assortment of scholars and amcha are saying these yes, these less so. Like Eli also said, we live in a culture, the halachic culture, where we don't say we just don't do it, right? There's justification. The question to ask, right, is which way is the justification running? Is the practice necessitating a textual justification, or is the textual justification necessitating practice, or are these things themselves iterative? That's, so part of my little talk about the case, and I think Sharon's point about the mandated reporting is exactly right. There was a Das Torah declaration by Aguda, right?
until its own community said, we're going to balance what that is. We're going to balance secular norms. We're going to balance secular law. We're going to balance how we want our community to look. And even, I think the story is almost the opposite. Even there, they pushed back until Aguda clarified and sort of shifted. And that spawned a community that's not quite Aguda, but adjacent to Aguda, to come out the other way. So all these things are, in other words, sure, 99 out of 100 times Das Torah is going to look and appear, but it's the one time it doesn't that tells you the other 99 times it's happening, not because of the Rambam's view of Das Torah, it's because of the people saying, we want to affiliate with this, and this is how we want to live, and that creates its strength.
Sure?
Nope.
Okay, so I actually, if I can push back on Chaim a little bit, excellent. That's all right. Here we go. So I'm not sure on the... On the same-sex marriage debate, I'm not sure it's only about signaling. I think that there still are different views within the amongst rabbis or within the community about the phenomenon of homosexuality. I think that there still are views that are what we in liberal society would consider retrograde, that don't accept the face value declarations of same-sex attraction. So I think that that's definitely part of the calculus, and I don't think it should be ignored. The other thing, in terms of the Shulchan Aruch as being definitive, so Maritz Chias is writing in the mid-19th century. In the mid-19th century, that's the first time that you really have alternatives to orthodoxy. You could probably even say that that's the first time that you have orthodoxy because it's the first time you have alternatives to orthodoxy. And so there's a process going on in the 19th century in Germany and in Hungary. Where are we drawing lines between boundaries? Where are we saying, okay, you are michutz l'machane because of whatever, and you're in the machane, right? And you have extreme reformists, people like Holdheim, and then you have the more moderate reformists like Aaron Chorin or Zacharia Frankel, and Maritz Chias is, let's say, on the liberal end of the traditional camp, and he's also sort of, like, he doesn't want to draw a thick black line between this community and that community. So what he's doing there, it seems to me, is he's pushing back on the Shulchan Aruch being the definition of what constitutes an Orthodox community. In Hungary in 1869, when there was a debate about communal norms and a debate about how the Jewish community in Hungary was going to be governed, and that Congress resulted in schism, the last-ditch effort to keep things together, and this was an effort that was led by Rav Israel Hildesheimer, who was also someone who's on the liberal end of the Orthodox spectrum, was let's all agree that to uphold the Shulchan Aruch as something binding. And he wasn't saying every single siman and sif of the Shulchan Aruch. We're going to pay homage. We're going to declare our fealty to the Shulchan Aruch. And it became a very clear marker, and it was used as a clear marker between one community and the next. So the question of these 50 simanim, we don't really follow what it says in the Shulchan Aruch. I think that this gets back to what Chaim was saying about signals, that declaring fealty to the Shulchan Aruch was a signal, whether it was or also a signal, it wasn't as much a real, there was no test to make sure that everybody was.
Of course, what do we do when that changes? And I guess the best example of that is the famous article of Chaim Soloveitchik, you know, some 25 years ago, how we are moving from a mimetic tradition to a traditional text, and then we're bringing back halachot that were sort of ignored. And how do we deal with that as a community, and who, I guess, in a sense, who decides? And, you know, is it the rabbis or the people, what they want to do? How does that play into it? Because we have moved that, and now that we're sort of, you know, everything on social media and how that affects halakha, we're now accepting, you know, people writing a paragraph on some platform. People are asking the question. They don't even know who the teacher responded. Halakha has moved from, you said you had a choice. You could ask this rabbi or that rabbi. Today, people ask the people they don't even know.
And if you make, if you want to comment on that, how that has affected halakha, the anonymity of the whole process we have today.
Okay. Somebody else want to start this time?
Go for it, Ali.
Yeah, go ahead.
All right. Okay. I have a talk called Rabbinic Authority in the Age of Rabbi Google. And I'll start with a story. Rabbi Yehuda Modena, who was an Italian rabbi, 16th century, he was once confronted by a person that he describes as an ignoramus. This was soon after the publication of the Shulchan Aruch, and he takes out his Shulchan Aruch, shows it to Yehuda Modena, and says, look at this, I got the Shulchan Aruch. I don't need no rabbi anymore. And in a certain sense, that was true, right? You have a handbook now that obviates the need for rabbis. So what I mean by that is that this is not the first time that technological change has made halacha more accessible, has made it more uniform, actually, but has also made halacha more accessible to the layperson. And I think that we do see that going on today with all the different available technologies, whether it's the Bar Ilan Response Project or Hebrew Books, or whether it's just search algorithms where you can type your halakha question into Google and get whatever response you want to get is going to come up in the list. So I think that, and this is not just in halakha, by the way, this is the question of the end of expertise has been written on. There are books about it. Chaim and I participated in a panel at Tel Aviv University a couple of years ago where we discussed this, how it manifests in the legal profession, how it manifests in the medical profession. And since then, I've articulated different paradigms on how different poskim are dealing with this. So the example, I'll use an example which is, it's brand new, the Nishmat website. Okay, and the book that was published based on responses from the Nishmat website called Nishmat Habayit. So what they're doing is, first of all, they signal their traditionalism by not claiming to be halachic experts, because all of the responsa, all of the people that are writing the responsa there are women, right? So Rabbanit Henkin, who is brilliant and very, very savvy, she starts off by saying, the women that are writing here, they're not writing as halachic, they're not poskim, even if that's exactly what they're doing. They're not poskim. What they're doing is they're giving the halacha in a way that the people will be able to receive it and accept it and understand it. Well, yeah, that's what poskim do, okay? And every single line, every single halachic position has been reviewed by real rabbis. Okay, it's such a great, just the paratexts of this book, Nishmat Habayit, is such a great text for understanding this dynamic. And then what they do is, each responsum, you have the question, and the question is usually a very difficult question that brings together all kinds of issues, right? There's a halachic issue, you know, issues of marital relations, when a woman is suffering from postpartum depression, things that are just, you don't just quote chapter and verse and say, oh, the halacha says this. There's the first answer, there's the question, then there's the first answer, which has no footnotes and has a very pastoral tone and combines halacha with just advice. And then there's the second responsum, it's lengthier, it's footnoted, and it brings together in much more detail and much more clinically what the halacha says and the opinions of mental health experts and the opinions of physical, you know, of physicians, generally gynecologists. And it weaves them together to present it in a way that's very interdisciplinary, and they'll say, and it's true, that they're providing a synthesis that other places can't provide. And I think that this is one of the ways of reasserting or reconstructing expertise, of building trust, of building credibility, and it comes in a lot of ways. The way that they write the pastoral answer, the way that they write the clinical answer, the way that they're self-deprecating in the sense that, well, we're not real response writers. And I even saw the first couple of reviews that came out of the book all said, well, this is not a classic work of responsa. Well, I study responsa pretty, you know, I like reading Tshuvot, right? It's my Chazarat Hashatz activity of choice. And there is no such thing as a classic work of responsa. They're all different. And sometimes it's just a Dropbox of things that this rabbi wrote. And sometimes it's there are greater and lesser degrees of editing. And they're all different. And in the sense that this is answers to questions, it is a classic work of responsa. But it's interesting that they're putting themselves out there in a way that they don't want to appear like a classic work of responsa. And that's part of what they're trying to do. We don't want to look like we're competing with the post-Gim. We want to look like something else. But in doing that, they're constructing a very different model of halachic authority.
Do they mean for the tshuva to be accepted as, you know, halacha?
Absolutely. That's right. Why they're writing it. That's why they're publishing it.
So I want to make two comments. And here I'll switch. I'll go to history where Eli went to modernity. So there's a form of 16th century tshuva that goes something like this. Question, poor widow owes rich gvir money under X and Y facts. Answer. Bava Basra says like this, Bava Kama says like this, Bava Mitzvah like this, the whole on this, and she has to give it to him. She has to pay him. Section 2. However, if you want to get an aliyah in my shul, and you want your kids to be married in this community, and you want to keep your seat on the Mizrachvant, you better settle with her in a way that she's happy. So this is another form of what Ellie's talking about, which is it's almost the reverse of the Nishmat form. It's let me set my authority up top, and I'm going to tell you that I know all the sugyas, and I know exactly how it's done, right? And I'm going to prove my authority to now tell you, aval anachtu bimkomenu, right? And now basically tell you, I'm not telling you what the halacha is. I'm just telling you as the rav of this town, this is my policy. And this is, I think, very, very similar structurally to what's going on here. And, you know, Ellie knows that that's a classic form. There's a famous tshuva, probably one of the most famous, the tshuva that really kicks off, we talked about this, the Tinok Shenishba paradigm for dealing with non-from Jews. So this is in Altoona, which is near Hamburg, in the middle of the 19th century. And Binyan Tzion, Ettlinger.
Yeah.
Right. So the Binyan Tzion is asked basically if a non, right, so like Ellie said, this is the first time where we have like non from Jews as a whole category. If they touch the wine, does it become usur midin yayin nesach? And he cites that the traditional answer to this is yes. And then he says, but efshir maybe alpi derech limud, etc., maybe they're counted as Tinuk Shenishba. Now, at the top of this tshuva, in the book, it's printed, L'halacha v'lo l'ma'aseh. So he says, right there, do not rely on this. To your question, did he expect them to rely on it?
Mark Shapiro told me that was added in by his children who thought the tshuva was too radical. But he never put that
so,
in the text.
So Judith Bleich disagrees. Mark Shapiro says this. Adam Fertzer has his article.
You can look it up. Most of Rav Yaakov Lettenlinger's response, he was for about 10 years, he was the editor of a rabbinic journal called Shomer Tzion HaNe'eman. More than 50% of his tshuvot were just things that he wrote into that journal. Meaning, if a lot of poskim sort of generate their authority from the ground, as from the grassroots, he astroturfed it 100%. he was the editor of Rabbinic Journal, so if he felt that he wanted to weigh in on a topic, he had a platform to do it. He wasn't necessarily getting all the questions. So you have to look and see what the year is and whether or not that tshuva first appears in Shomer Tzion HaNe'eman.
But of course, even when a posek writes, it's not the Maaseh, he doesn't really mean it.
Well, but that's
the point. He doesn't mean it exactly as he says it.
The other point I would make is, because you talked about that all these things are bidirectional, because you asked about the things becoming more text-based and less mimetic. So 2 years ago, I wrote an article called How Halacha Changes from Nachem to the Tisha B'Av Kumzitz. And I described the phenomenon like this. If you look in the Halacha, in the textual tradition, here's what we know about Tisha B'Av. You're not supposed to learn Torah. You're not supposed to get together. You're not supposed to be in community. You're supposed to be forlorn. And I expect many of you, even when I grew up, and many in this room when you grew up, that's basically what Tisha B'Av was. Tisha B'Av today, in most communities, is a day spent learning Torah.
Correct.
I always joke that, especially on the right-wing communities, they get more screen time on Tisha B'Av than any other day of the year.
That's right. The only day they can watch a movie.
That's right. And as you know, because they now videoed this, NCSY and Bnei Akiva, there's now this Tisha B'Av Kumzitz, where you have, I don't know, several thousand, guys in the Kotel Plaza singing and swaying and hugging. And if you don't know, you go quickly, is this Yom HaTzmaut, Yom Yerushalayim, or Tisha B'Av? It's hard to know. It really is. I've showed pictures to people. So if you look at the shoes, you see, fine. But like, but in Israel, maybe that doesn't matter either. But anyway, so in other words, my point is, the whole debate about whether to change Nachem, it gets very contentious, and basically Nachem is the same. But right underneath that, at a level, I would say, Rabbi, that is in deep tension with the textual tradition, you have the Minhag tradition take over. And the answer is, has there been a response about Tisha B'Av in post-67? Yes, just don't look in the sitter. Look at your webcam.
Sure.
So I was actually going to switch and take in a slightly different direction, because one of the issues that you talked about was Rabbi Google. And I use Dr. Google all the time. For those of you who don't know it, anytime somebody in my family gets an ailment, I Google it up, I research it, I suddenly have a PhD and I can diagnose. It's quite amazing.
And it works.
And it works. However,
Judge Google.
Yeah, that's another one. Well, there's Google Lawyer, there's Dr. Google, and there's Rabbi Google. So many people from a halachic standpoint sort of say, okay, well, if you're writing to somebody who's, you don't know, they don't know you, there are rabbis out there, you just put out your question, a response comes back. I think the OU has a site. I think YU has a site. I think the Yoetz and Halachot have a site. Everybody has a site where you can ask a question. And I think law, medicine, and halacha are really all on the same footing, in that you really need to see the person, the client, the patient to make the right decision, diagnosis, or anything like that. So as much as I can go up and see, do I have a broken wrist, I don't really know until I go and I see my doctor or I have my x-ray. Whether I have bronchitis and it's a virus and I need antibiotics, or whether it's something different, I don't really know. Dr. Google can only tell me so much, but you have to actually apply it. I often see, when I was a lawyer, I had a number of clients who would come up to me and say, well, I read or I know, and until you actually apply the facts. So halacha works in very much the same way, in that you go to a specific rabbi, not because you know that he gave this, well, some people do this, a lot of people will go to a specific rabbi because they gave that answer to one specific person. And it always amazes me that if I were then to go to that rabbi and ask the same question, I would sometimes get a different answer, because you have to take the person, you have to take the halakha, you have to take the circumstances, and you have to apply it. But it's not necessarily a bad thing, because what you end up getting is a whole generation of people who are now educated. so that when you do go to your doctor and you say, here's are the symptoms, and I know to tell you the symptoms because I've read some of them, these apply to me or these don't, or you have a medication that's just not working for you, and you say to them, well, look, I read about this medication, what do you think? Or you go to a lawyer and you say, well, you know, I've read that this person had this type of agreement, can I do that? Can I enter? It educates a person, just like when somebody goes to a rabbi and says, I've done my homework, and this is what I know, and it makes a more educated and a more learned person. And I think when you're dealing with millennials, you get a lot of that. You get a lot of work being done before they even approach, you know, sort of the final say-so. And it's not a bad thing for people to educate themselves. And when you're talking about who decides, we're making the jobs, education sometimes makes the job harder on the person making the decision. But it very often makes people think, and it challenges the person making the decision. So when we're talking about who decides, and you're talking about Rabbi Google, I think it's an excellent thing. Not that you're deciding necessarily for yourself, but you now know the questions that you should be asking. You now have the background information, and you can now approach it with the rabbi in a different... And sometimes you find rabbis who don't have... who will look at things a different way because you come from it from a different approach. So that was just answering your Rabbi Google question.
No, for sure. So okay.
Go ahead. An interesting point is that in the responsa literature, the questions are usually not posed by the lay. The question is usually posed by the secondary or tertiary elite, meaning it's rabbis of one town that are asking questions to who they deem to be a superior rabbi. So that's we see almost like there's a flattening going on today, and this is building on what Sharon's saying, that in the responsa literature, it was an elite that was responding to a secondary elite, an elite that was responding to a group that was already very educated that weren't coming in cold. And I think that what we see today in terms of the shaping of how these things are being shaped is that even in other fields, in halacha as well, and in other fields, you have the need to respond, that an expert is somebody that knows how to respond to the educated secondary elite, to somebody that has a background and not to somebody coming in cold off the street. So it's an interesting...
And are the responses different? When a layperson asks a question, they will probably, you know, how do you see the differences, answers given to a layperson who may not understand all the nuance, or to put it in more other terms, all the halachic books written in English are all super machmir because they're for a lay audience.
Not all. I am the editor of Pnei Halacha.
Okay, but in America, often you'll find in the footnotes the kula. So, but that's sort of the same thing for a lay audience.
You put the chumras in the footnotes.
You put the chumras in the footnotes. That's why it's a popular book.
Yes.
Okay.
But the answers are quite different when you have a lay person asking the questions.
And how does that affect the halachic process?
Well, in part, that there are these multiple tiers, right? And this is sort of right. There's the official line, right? And then there's the footnote line, right? And this all gets back to, like, what do we mean by the halacha? Is it, it's always some complicated combination of what's in the books, and then not what, like, random people, but what the committed community does, right? And those shape each other. Because then you see, right? And the minhag is, right? The halacha is this. You could almost say that about a third of the ramas have this quality to them, right? It means that if the straight learning of the sort of simplest reading of the sugya is X, and then the rama says, now sometimes he means like b'minhagim in like official sifrei minhagim, which themselves, of course, reflect communal practice. And sometimes he clearly means this is what people do. But the people are not like the orchi uparchi. They're the people who he respects as embodying a minhag. And therefore, that then gets put in the Ramah. And once it's in the Ramah, it's now shifted from minhag to halacha, even though the Ramah says v'chei nahagu.
Okay, I want to open up the floor to questions. So what I ask everybody to do, please, is I'll put the mic here. Come up. Keep them as questions, please, short and to the point. We'll take four or five questions in one shot, and then they can respond sort of all together.
Thank you for a very enlightening presentation, Mal. I'd like to focus on two words, change and signals. Professor Schachter, and I've heard him on many occasions say, halacha doesn't change, facts change, but halacha stays permanent. And on the point of modern Orthodox rabbis saying like movies, etc., this happens in the Haredi world as well. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, there's footnotes in the Chakira articles, I can't remember the source right now, but where he says, I'd like to say that, but the Olam won't let me say that. I have a friend who's a professor at U of T, lives in Israel, and learns with Usher Weiss, and he questions him about some of the things because he realizes he's a more enlightened fellow than most Haredi poskim and gedolim, and he says, I can't say it, I'd like to be able to say it. So how is our halacha any different than reform and conservative, if your characterization that signals change, etc., we might not be as radical in the change, but are we making change based on what society is dictating? Because basically that's what reform and conservative is. Progressive, more liberal mores are what their oilam feels is right, and that becomes their halacha. Why is ours any different than their system?
Mm-hmm. All right, I wanted to respond also to a comment that Rabbi Simon made. I think it's in a similar vein to the previous question of when you say, you know, everyone agrees that, you know, homosexuality is austere and prohibited. It's just a matter of, you know, how we handle them, how do we, you know, approach them. And I was wondering, well, if we're just going to go ahead and, you know, practically act on communal norms, you know, what is the value of just saying it's prohibited? You know, we're going to pay lip service to the halacha, but then once it comes into practice, there's no actual practical difference. A second question that I had was more to beyond just the relationship to the rabbi's rabbinic structure to the community, is the rabbinic structure to the secular courts as well? You know, for example, I mean, Justice Shore mentioned that there's no, the Beit Din doesn't really have much coercive power in their decision making, but where they do, in places that they do, and I don't know if this is area of expertise, how, like, for like when decisions in the base of the Beit Din go according to rules that are not according to the secular courts, for example, women's testimony not being validated. First of all, how does the rabbinic structure handle that kind of thing? And second of all, how do the secular courts respond to a Beit Din that doesn't follow basic judicial practice?
So this is more a comment for Chaim Seyman, but I'd be interested to know, like, it's, I guess the question is his reaction to it. So the way you started off framing is talking about you have a rabbinic authority in the middle, but then there are these other factors. So the way I would frame it is that when we actually make a halachic, it's like a lay person deciding how should I act in a particular way. I think that the rabbinic authority is only one data point. So you have four actual elements that everybody weighs to some level or another. So there's rabbinic authority, there's normative practice in your community, there's textual evidence, and then there's your brain, like what makes sense to you. So that's how I would frame it, because rather than have, you know, the rabbinic authority is the center, and then you have the concentric circle, and then the other influence, I think that you actually have these four elements, and everybody uses them in every decision to one extent or another.
I think that, especially we're talking about current times, postmodern times, that you talked about the idea about signaling, some kind of a magical message that comes out from the rabbinic authority to the community. So what I would like, I mean, it's not really magical, but it's invisible. So I would love to hear a little bit more about how you see that relationship nowadays I would say, in modern Orthodoxy. How would you characterize the relationship between the posek, the rabbi, and not the individual, but the community, because community is still important. And I just wanted to ask about the silent partner in that relationship, namely God.
Okay. Well, who wants to start first?
I think I'm supposed to. But go ahead.
Well, I'm obviously going to start with the secular, the question about the secular courts, and I'll give my friends here some time to ponder some of the really good deep questions that were asked. So one of the questions was, what do you do with a Beit Din if they don't have the authority today? For example, again, using family law as an example, if it's no longer enforceable by the secular courts, where does the Beit Din get their authority? So the authority obviously comes from the community. It comes from, if a siruv is issued by the Beit Din, our people, our shuls and rabbeim going to respond and adhere to it? It really comes down to, are we giving them the authority to make these decisions? And since the answer to that is yes, we've got a structured Beit Din in Toronto, then it turns around, although they may not be enforceable, certain things may not be enforceable by the courts, that it's the community then that will decide, yes, we're giving them the authority or we're not giving them the authority. And when you're dealing with issues such as corporate commercial issues that our Beit Din deals with them, I would say yes, on the whole, they do have the authority because the community gives it to them. The other question was asked is, what do you do, or what would the judicial system do when something comes before them, a halakhic issue comes before them, and conflicts with the secular system? Well, clearly as a judge, I have to uphold the laws of our country, that the halakha doesn't really play a role at all in decision making, but there are certainly exceptions to it, and there are a few things. Number one, we live in a society where freedom of religion is ensconced in our constitution, so that unless there is a reason to interfere, the courts are not going to interfere with halakhic decisions. So unless somebody comes before the courts and says, something has happened that interferes with my secular rights, my with the law, the court's really going to allow them. So, for example, custody and access is a great example of that. What you do at home with your children, you have the absolute right to raise your children as Orthodox Jews, to say they're not going to drive on Shabbat, they're going to learn Torah, you get the decision, you don't have to send them to secular schools. You can send them to schools that aren't even authorized by the state, in the sense that they don't have to even follow a curriculum. If you do something to a child, such as abuse your child, which comes under the secular authority, obviously, even if you say this is certain things are permitted under halakha, it's not going to be allowed and it's not going to be permitted. I mean, that's a very silly example, but that's one example. You can contract out of you can contract into accepting halakha. So, for example, again, going back to the issue of custody and access, and that's because I come from a family law background, that's what I know, but I'm quite sure there are examples in other areas of law. But, for example, if you sign an agreement with your spouse and you say, we are going to raise this child as an Orthodox child, and that if we cannot agree on something, we're going to allow this rabbi to make the determination, that's going to be upheld by the courts because you've entered into an agreement. And again, as long as it doesn't violate the law and as long as it continues to be in the best interest of the child, that is going to be upheld by the courts. And the courts won't interfere and aren't in the practice of interfering with religious rights.
Okay. What makes us different from Reform and Conservative? Excellent question. So there are a lot of different ways to answer that question. if you're looking for, we can answer with doctrinal differences. We can answer with halachic differences. We can answer with social differences. But I guess the when it comes down to it, the question is, okay, if we're saying that halacha changes, and they're saying that halacha changes, why are our halachic changes okay and their halachic changes aren't? So I'm going to bring an example, someone that I mentioned earlier, who was a real mechadesh. He was he offered many novel interpretations of the Talmud, novel interpretations of halacha. But the thing that he's best known for, the thing that he's known for more than anything else, is a statement, Chadash Asar Min HaTorah. Everything new is forbidden. Okay. We talk about signaling. There's your signal. Rav Asher Weiss says all the time that he doesn't consider himself a mechadesh. He doesn't consider himself an innovator, except that he's constantly innovating. But he says, I don't consider myself an innovator. I learn the Gemara, I learn the Rishonim, I learn all the relevant material, and I think that this is the Pashut Pshat. Okay, so nobody's ever said this before. But this is the way to read it. This is the way to understand it. And I'm fond of saying that Rav Asher Weiss and Rav Avi Weiss can say the exact same thing. Rav Asher Weiss will be like, oh, Rav Asher Weiss says that, we're makel on this. And if Rav Avi Weiss says it, then they'll vote him off the island. This is where, you know, signaling is, it's a funny word, right? It's a signal. A friend of mine came up with this, it's a zany idea. He called it frum points. Oh,
that's my signal. It's a concentric circle.
Right. He called it frum points. He says that, what are frum points? He says that certain practices that you do, you get a certain amount of frum points for it. So for example, there was this one rabbi who he was known for being fairly liberal, except that he wore a black hat and a dark yarmulke, and he had the worst beard in the world. He had a terrible looking beard. Very wispy. It looked like an armpit, okay? And he got so much credibility because of that beard. Like, that guy, he grows that, he must be really firm. We can trust him. He's credible. He has real fealty to our tradition. Why? Because he's got that beard. Another friend of mine who's a rabbi in another community, he's a graduate of a yeshivish yeshiva. He recently brought a yoetzet to speak in his community. And there were a few people in his community and a number of people in the city outside of his community who were really critical. How could you bring in a yoetzet halacha, a woman to teach halacha? How could you do such a thing? And he says to me, I can't be seen in public without my hat on for the next 4 months. Right? So there's this constant, the question really is, it's not what are you signaling, it's how do you convey that you're trustworthy? How do you build trust? How do you, right? And this is bi-directional. From the side of the community, it's who do we trust? And from the side of the producer of halacha, from the supply side, as Chaim calls it in his economic modeling of halacha, how do I convey it? How do I convey trust? How do I have other people trust me? So I don't know if this answer is going to satisfy you in terms of what separates Orthodox from Reform. But I think a lot of it has to do with this question of how we perceive things as change or not change. Right? I think it gets back to the old dilemma of the ship of Theseus. Right? In the parable of the ship of Theseus, Theseus is sailing on this ship. A board rots, it's replaced, another board rots, it's replaced. Eventually, every single board in the entire ship has been replaced. And the philosophical dilemma is this still the same ship? Is this still the ship of Theseus? And I think that the way to overcome that, if you want to say that this is still the ship of Theseus, is that you need to have a narrative. You need to have a perception or a memory or an experience that I've been on this ship the whole time and I experience a continuity with this ship. So even if every single plank has been replaced over time, it's that memory, it's that continuity that generates the identity of this ship as being still the ship of Theseus. And I think that there's a similar dynamic. I don't want to say that every single board on the ship of Halakha has been replaced. I think that's, I don't believe that, and I think that that would get me voted off the island. But
you're not on the island.
Could be. It could be. But I think that there's a similar dynamic at play, right? That we have this experience.
But if they're afraid to say what they really think of cases, what does that say about Halakha?
Well, I think you guys almost answered your questions in a certain sense. First of all, I'll incorporate by reference what both Ellie and Sharon said. But the statement of when a posek says, I want to say it, I would like to be able to say it, but they won't let me. To me, that's a perfect example of this, that this posek is intuiting that the community is not going to accept it. By the way, Lakula, in your example, sometimes Lachomra, sometimes Lakula, right? And I think perfectly expresses this point. Now, when I talk about signals, I don't think it's very different from Ellie's Frim points. In other words, signals just merely like, but like what, look, the question is, what creates normativity? What creates a feeling of normativity, of bindingness, of authority? Now, one thing we know, right, just experientially in our world, is that, I would say, more religiously conservative communities are much better at doing that, and more religiously liberal communities are much worse at doing that. And that's the way I would sort of, you know, take the Frim points point. And it's like, whose signals count and how? And that's what I was trying to get to with the concentric circles. That someone who otherwise appears to be constantly committed and is always signaling that. And by the way, I don't mean signaling in like a facetious way. I mean like showing up to chakras. That's not why you're showing up to chakras, but like you are, right? Is more in the core of this point. And in Ellie's terms, would get more Frim points, and is a more reliable predictive signal about how the entire system works. The very fact that you have a posek say, "I'd love to say this, but I can't," I think is almost answering your question.
Because what is halacha truth? Is it the Bar Hashem?
Sure. So let's talk about
it. If the rabbi thinks X, but he won't say X.
Because it's about the way the Kahala Kadisha lives Dvar Hashem. It's the exact same way, right? This is why in Ashkenaz, in medieval Ashkenaz, it's more Ellie's world than mine, right? They saw themselves as the Kahala Kadisha, and therefore their minhag took on halachic weight. Now, it's not the minhag of like some like random people, right? It's the minhag of people we trust, and that's Ellie's point of trust. Where does God fit in? I think all these people are trying, exactly what Rashi says. So, ideally, we're all trying to live out the Dvar Hashem. The facts halacha thing is very interesting, right? Because a couple examples came up. So let's go to our Tinuk Shenishpa. So Tinuk Shenishpa in the Gemara applies to like literally a person, a child, a baby who's captured, raised by the Amorim or whatever, and then like shows back up. Now comes in the 19th century, Rav Ettlinger, and says all these people who are, you know, we call them Reform, whatever you want to call them, are Tinokot Shenishpa. So is that the facts changing or is that the halacha changing? I don't know. If you want to describe it as facts, sure. New facts come up. But we're always, to your point, we're always applying to the facts. You know, Aisha, to the point that was asked, does not do Eidus. That remains true. You can't, the halacha is such. But a woman comes in to a Beis Din and she provides an Amanus. She provides an Umdina. Facts, halacha, I don't know. Right? It depends. If you're a more formalist, would say, no, Eidus is Eidus, these are other things. A slightly more realist approach would see that these are functional equivalents and would see some kind of dialogue here. As to, you know, I think what Ellie said is right. In other words, I would call it the Kahala Kadisha. In other words, the Argonaut ship, or that's the way we did it in law school, is a way of saying, and there are ways to test it. They generate a sense of commitment and normativity. And I think part of what we, as a community, modern Orthodox or non-modern Orthodox, right? I think as a Haredi society also changes, right? We all know this. Is always trying to say, how can we retain that essential character of us of living out God's word, despite, you know, with these planks changing? Finally, I'd say, I think, sorry, your name, Melech? The point is right. I think those are, that's a very helpful sort of, I was trying to keep a very simple model, because of course to some degree the question we're asking is that authoritative voice in the middle, whether it's a text or a person, how does that person become in the middle, right? They're not born there, right? Rav Moshe Feinstein wasn't born in the middle of the circle of American halacha. He got there precisely because people are arranging themselves to some degree around him. And I think what, why is for all those four points you said. The trust point is like, you read a tshuva, and sometimes it's convincing and sometimes it's not. I think, to me, and Ellie and I have talked about this, part of the reason Rav Asher, I think, Weiss has sort of, and I think he's an interesting example because it's like happening before our eyes. Our kids will see him maybe like we see Rav Moshe. It's just there. But we're watching it happen. And how are we watching it happen? Because you read the tshuva like, oh, that's really interesting. I really like those reading the sugya. That really makes sense. And every time that happens, sort of the circle is arranged where he's now more in the middle of for that group, and for other people, other people.
I do want to get back to one of the questions was about Beit Din and coercion. So Beit Din in the last few hundred years have changed dramatically. Right? The Beit Din throughout medieval and early modern society were...
Of course.
They were coercive, and they were constitutional, meaning the Jewish community was enfranchised as a corporate entity, and the Beit Din was, at least for certain types of cases, was considered the venue at which cases would be seen. And as legal norms changed throughout the world, legal norms changed in Beit Din as well. So already in the late Middle Ages, you have acceptance of testimony by women. Again, using mechanisms like the ones that Chaim described, either as that they ne'emanut, or that it was by making a takana, a communal, by legislating a communal norm that women's testimony is trusted. Already in the late Middle Ages, women were keeping the books, right? That women, you know, husbands and wives were in business together, and women were keeping books. So how could you trust what a woman is writing in the business's ledger? And the answer is, of course you trust it. Of course you have to trust it, right? And the legal mechanism, that comes later. How do we figure it out? That comes later. It's like Al Capone. How are we going to nail him? I don't know. Figure something out. Tax evasion sounds good. Why do we want to nail him? Because he's a gangster. Okay. So you have the telos, where you want to take it, comes before the mechanism that justifies it. And a variety of mechanisms were used. Sometimes it was a creative reinterpretation. Sometimes it was by making an actual legislation. I just translated a paper for Rami Reiner dealing with a particular case of that there was a takana in France in the 1100s that even though according to the din of the Gemara, as soon as a woman is married, her husband becomes the legal inheritor of the dowry. And there was a takana made in France. First, there was a radical rereading of the sugya by Rabbeinu Tam. Then there was a takana made that until the end of the first year, or as long as the dowry money is still in the hands of the woman's family, the husband is not the inheritor. Right? And this was considered to be justice because dowries were a significant portion of a family's earnings or a family's savings. Yes. And if a woman, if a young woman married a man and then tragically died without producing any children very, you know, soon thereafter, then essentially this becomes a gift of a significant amount of the family's wealth to this man who is never going to have anything to do with the family again. So it was a restorative justice type of model. But the question is, what mechanisms are you going to use to do that? You figure out the mechanisms.
Any other questions? Okay, so maybe I'll just...
We've solved it all. So.
Okay. Yeah. Maybe I'll conclude just with...
We forgot about God. I think somebody... Okay. There's a question about God?
I'll ask the other question. There's there's a signaling and there's an expectation to all Jews. When you talk about certain circles and whatever, and what is the expectation to all Jews in terms of what kind of questions people can ask? What's the responsibility of the POSEC to the entire community? And I really would love to hear something about eternity here. I mean, the beauty of halakha is that it's changing, but we're going to have one little part to worry about God at the end, maybe, or is that completely inappropriate?
It's entirely appropriate. I just don't want to go first.
I mean, part of this process.
Well, again, I think that's the, to me, it only makes sense if people think they and see themselves and are trying to live out God's word. I mean, that, right? Otherwise, the whole thing like falls apart. Now, it's true that we could describe, you know, when I talk about, you could describe lots of social spheres as signaling, right? But what counts as a signal is not an abstract point in our system. And as I said, I think I would phrase it when we talk about communities of being not a kahal, just a kahal, but a kahal kadishta. And that second word of kadusha, right, is exactly this. So we're not trying to, you know, be the best, Rotary Club, right? We're trying to live out that which we understand to be God's word. And that carries, I mean, there's far more conservatism in this subgroup than in most others in modernity, in part because, you know, that's a big part of it. Now, part of what we're arguing here is sort of at the margins, right? At the difficult questions. But and that's why I started. Let's think not of the continuity. It's like, we all just kept Shabbos. Now you're like, duh, of course. But like, that's actually pretty amazing, right? X thousand years ago, the Torah is given, it says keep Shabbos. And like, here we are. So yeah, we can argue about today, do we like use LEDs instead of this? And blah, 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 blah. Like, oh, fine. Right, but to me, that's why I started. It's actually the phenomenon that's actually most interesting, precisely for all the sociological reasons that Ellie talked about, in terms of the breakdown of the community and the authorities, the fact that we're all still here, we're all still doing this. Look at the books on the shelves of this room. It's a high school, it's a kollel, and here we are. Like, this actually makes no sense. This is actually shocking, if you think about it from a sociological perspective and all the changes in humanity. Why? I think because we do constitute ourselves a Kahal Kadisha because we're trying to do what God wants. Now, at the margins, we're going to ask about, right, when there's a lot, and we live in an era, right, where the rate of social change is very high, right, technological, social, everything comes, so we get some friction, and we're dealing with that, sometimes better, sometimes not, right? But I would just say, like, to me, God is honestly manifests the fact that we're here doing this. It's highly improbable.
So I think I want to think about this in one way, and then I want to address the God question as well. So there are different ways to understand how, you know, the nature of halachic rules. So I'm going to use one that's a painful one specifically to illustrate this point. I'm going to use the example of Mamzerut. The product of some form of illicit sexual union. Now, the question is, how do we understand what Mamzerut is? Is Mamzerut some sort of essential feature of this child, or this person, or is Mamzerut, is it something that we're reading as a deterrent? That legislation, the Torah's legislation of Mamzerut, is something that is to discourage certain types of behavior, certain types of bad behavior. And that the Mamzerut, that the result of a Mamzer, the resulting Mamzer, is almost as a sign, a signal to the community that this is what happens when you misbehave. Okay? Now, there is a tradition of taking that essentialist view, that this realist view, that there is something intrinsically wrong with a mamzer. I recently came across a responsum from the 18th century in Italy, and all the weird responsa are from Italy. Just take that as a general rule. The weirdest responsa are from Italy, where at question was that in one of the Italian cities, a mamzer was born, and there was apparently some kind of tradition that when a child was born, a mamzer was born, they would tattoo the word mamzer on the child's forehead so that the child would not be able to escape his or her fate. I kid you not. That is an extreme essentialist view, and not one that I would advocate in any way, shape, or form.
Is that a case of assez de raison?
Yeah, the tattoo issue is sort of secondary here. Will he be buried in a Jewish cemetery? No. Forget that. Okay. And then there's but if you understand it as a deterrent, which I think is the mainstream view, then all of a sudden, the role of the posek becomes very different. The role of the posek is not that of a scientist, somebody who is trying to determine the essential reality here, but the role of the posek is someone who understands that from any sort of, on any intrinsic level, this child is the same as any other child, right? But the question is, can we keep this deterrent structure in place without, but still figure out a way to welcome this child into the community? And I think that that's the dynamic. I think the dynamic is we understand the need for deterrence, we understand the need for consequences, right? And there are people that will say, and I've made this mistake in my own life. Oh, somebody that's born a mamzer, it's like a child born with AIDS. It's inheritable, right? Well, AIDS is something that's intrinsic. AIDS is something that's it's in the bloodstream. Mamzerut is not something that's in the bloodstream. So how do we justify to ourselves the fact that mamzerim still exist? Right? This is where the dynamic plays out. If we accept the view that it's a deterrent and that it's a nominalist approach toward law, meaning that it's the norm that creates the reality and it's not an intrinsic reality, then the role of the posek is to maintain the stability of the system while at the same time trying to figure out a way to accommodate this particular instance, right? So on the wholesale level, things remain as they were, that mamzerut is mamzerut. But on the retail level, things are different. There's an individual psak. And from there, I'll go to the question of God in this whole thing. Okay, I think once you start thinking along these lines of social, of what kind of society, that the Torah is not a scientific textbook. The Torah is not describing essential intrinsic realities. The Torah is giving us a blueprint for how to build a society, how to build communities, how to build a civilization. We read in this week's Parsha, okay, here we go, we're in Drusha mode, we're in Dvar Torah mode. We read in this week's Parsha how at the culmination of this process that began with the Exodus, right, and continued with, you know, through the giving of the Torah, through the Egel, so finally we get down to it. There's a Mishkan, and the people build the Mishkan, and the culmination of the building of the Mishkan is that God dwells in their midst. The Shekhinah comes down and lives in their community. Right? And this is a paradigm. This is an archetype of the kinds of communities that we are trying to build. We want to build communities in which God dwells. Okay? And we want to build a civilization. And when it comes to Israel, we want to build a country in which God dwells. And this is the dynamic. How do we build such a country? What kind of norms, what kind of society is a society within which God can inhere, in which God can dwell? And I think that's really what we're getting at. And I think that every posek and every individual, right, somehow is dealing with that question of how are we making our community more godly, more livable by God? And I think that a lot of these questions they're hard questions, but ultimately I think they're questions of how we find the right balance of building a community in which God is present.
Sure. And just answering or going back to the question about the difference between conservative reform and orthodoxy, you know, we've been talking a lot here about social norms, about maintaining, the words that we've been using have been about maintaining and accommodating and applications of law, you know, and if we're talking about these types of changes in halakha, what makes us different? But at the end of the day, and as Eli said here, there's a, the Torah is basic. There are certain things that are never going to change. In social, in secular law, the laws, the basic laws can change. In halakha, the basic laws that are being applied, that are being, are always being maintained. There's a basic level there that will never, not even a level, there's a halakha there that will never change, and it's really the application to changes of fact, to changes of norms that are changing. And I go back, I was at a UGA breakfast, I think a year or so ago, and the chief rabbi was there, Rabbi Lau was there. And I'll never forget, there was a female rabbi who stood up and said, you know, our grandfathers, or your father and my father, were both rabbis. They were both friends. They both respected each other. She was having difficulty understanding why Rabbi Lau was not accepting her as a female rabbi. And he said to her, he said, you know, I have, as an individual, I have respect for you. He said, but in my great-great-grandchildren, my great-great-granddaughter is going to be lighting candles the same way that my wife does now and the same way that her great-great-great-great-grandmother did. And my son is going to be putting on tefillin just like my great-great-great-great-grandfather did and my great-great-great-great-grandson is going to do. And I think for me that was a very powerful. So there are certain basic tenets that are not even tenets, but halakha that's never going to change. And what I think we've been talking about here is the application to the facts. And it's going back to the Dr. Google and the, you know, the Google lawyer, that it's how it gets applied and what the norms are within that framework is what we've really been talking about today.
Right. Okay. And she might also put on tefillin.
Gotcha. Really, I want to thank you all for really very interesting evening.
Sorry. Yeah.
I want to thank David and Noli Maretsky. That's all I'll say. Thank you. Thank you all. Laila Tov, and try to get a good night's sleep.